Today's scripture reading is Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 9 through 26. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise have eyes in their heads, while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish? Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And this is the word of God.
There you go. What more can be said? Happy Sunday. We ordered the weather to fit the passage this morning. We have started a series, if you were here last week, on what we're calling public faith, sharing the hope that is within. And one of the reasons that we're doing that is because, obviously, living in New York City, it's a very pluralistic culture. There's a lot of people with whom we live, work, and play who don't share our various deeply held beliefs. And for those of us who are Christians, when you get into those situations, whether it's at work or in your neighborhood or the people that you are living with, it poses the question, right? Do you hide what you believe? Do you keep your faith private? And if you don't, which the Bible calls you out not to do that, then how do you do it, frankly, in such a way that promotes peace and civility and without compromising your own personal integrity about who you are and what you believe? That's the challenge. That's what it means to be a Christian. Always, but particularly in a highly pluralistic culture. But that's the point is, it's not just an exercise for religious people, because that is the challenge. All you have to do is see what's going on in our politics today. And how do you get along in the public square when people hold various different beliefs? There was an op-ed piece years ago by David Brooks in the Times called "Is the Human Community Possible?" in which he posed the question, there's been a sharp rise in the number of people who thinks it's insane to have a human community, that we can get along in the public square. Because instead of emphasizing our common community, people are more likely to emphasize the distances and the conflicts that we have in our cultures. See, the point is, and we talked about this last week, that everybody in this room, regardless of what you believe about Christianity, even if you consider yourself an agnostic or an atheist or whatever your particular stripe, everybody in here is religious. Everybody in here is a person of faith. Everybody holds deep core beliefs about who they are and why they're here and the way the world works that you cannot empirically prove. So we all come to the public square. We all hold these beliefs. And the question is, how do we persuade people in a way, people who differ from us, that doesn't demonize, condemn, or destroy, but with respect and humility, is persuasive about what we hold? That is the question, right, in our culture. How do you do that? So this is our part as a Christian community to say, what can we do, those of us who are Christians, to help in that conversation? So for the next couple of months, what we're going to do is look at various topics that are kind of universal to the human condition, and look at them through the lens of Christianity, through the lens of the person of Jesus. In addition to that, the east side, west side, downtown congregations, we hope to have thousands of people in our community groups. There's a lot of you here who are in community groups. You're going through this series with us, and you're engaging with people who don't necessarily believe what you believe, and listening, actively listening to their questions, not persuading, but listening, so that we can become better as citizens in the public square about what we believe. So if you're not in a group, get in one. This is the time to do it, and you can follow us along over the next 6 or 7 weeks. Now today, we come to a passage that really gets to the heart of what it means to be human, right? Is there any meaning in life? Is there any purpose in life? Is there any significance to who I am? Is there any hope of finding some kind of permanent joy and peace and contentment? Or is it all just fleeting? Is it really just a chasing after the wind? So we're going to explore that question together before we come to the table and look at it in three ways, by looking at what this passage teaches us, which is a quest, a challenge, and a glimpse. A quest that we share, which is a quest for meaning and joy and peace and significance. The challenge that we fail, which is the failure is we take on that quest and we fail if we look for it under the sun. We'll come back to that. It's a line that's repeated over and over again in the book of Ecclesiastes. The challenge that we fail to find that meaning under the sun, and then the glimpse that we see that there's a way out of despair and meaninglessness, and what Kierkegaard called the sickness unto death, which is the name of the sermon. So the quest, the challenge, and the glimpse. First, the quest. I won't spend a lot of time on this, but just booting off of verse 10, I denied myself nothing. I refused my heart, no pleasure. My heart took delight. The heart, as you know, if you've come around, been around at all, the church, in the ancient understanding of the heart was a GPS for your soul. It was your will. It was your motives. It was your mind. It was everything. And so this quest that we have is to find delight, to find satisfaction, to find fulfillment, to find significance in our heart. That we all share that quest to find something permanent and purposeful in our lives. And it was an ancient quest. I mean, obviously in the Bible, there was in the Hebrew text, in the very first psalm, blessed is the one whose delight is the name of the Lord. Blessed is happiness. Blessed is deep soul contentment. This is the way that the English word for what we're questing, what we're searching for. But in the very last book of the Bible, Revelation, blessed are those who hear God's words and take it into your heart. And Jesus himself, and maybe his most famous of all sermons, right? The Sermon on the Mount, as it's known, the Beatitudes. Those Beatitudes are blessedness. 9 different ways. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the meek. What is he doing? He's pulling at the quest of the human heart for happiness, for significance, for purpose, for meaning, for something eternal in a transient world. But it isn't just religious people. In the Greek culture, it was something that people aspired to. And it was an aspiration that people had that was a word that was used that you could attain somehow the state of the gods. Because if you were a god, right? I mean, if you aspired to that, the gods had what? They had so much wealth, so much good fortune, so much protection that no bad thing could ever happen. And that's what it means to be human. You want to get there. You want to become like that. So that's how the ancient people reflected that quest. But we're no different. There are these philosopher poets called the Indigo Girls, you know, that I think actually somebody mentioned to me they were interviewed on NPR this morning. But they have this great song, Closer I Am to Fine. And this is how they express in their anthem. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountain. There's more than one answer to these questions pointing me in a crooked line. It's a great line. It's a quest. I went to the mountains. I went to the children. I went to the I went everywhere. I'm looking for meaning. I'm looking for contentment. I'm looking for joy. Why am I here? In New York Magazine, several years ago, there was an article called The Dark Thoughts on Happiness. And it says this, New York is the destination people come to realize their dreams, right? This is the quest we're on. A lot of you know that. But in many ways, the Big Apple is the perfect moniker for the city because the apple is the cause of the fall of human happiness. Garden of Eden, right? It's the symbol of that desire for something more, that even though paradise was paradise, they were still restless. A lot of you have come to New York because you're on that quest for blessedness. You've come to make it in the arts, right? And somehow, deep down, you think that outer applause that you're going to get is going to translate into the inner applause that your soul so desperately needs. Or some of you maybe have come to make it in the world of business or finance or law or fashion or whatever it is, and there's a sense in which, and all those things are great, by the way, but deep down, what do we want? We want the material wealth and success to translate into emotional wealth and success and psychological wealth and success and social wealth and success. Or let's face it, New York City has everything you could possibly desire. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, they will deliver it to your door. Every comfort and hedonistic pleasure you could possibly want, and you can have it. And we hope, deep down, that when we can see the things we want and we can consume them, that somehow it's going to satisfy a deeper hunger, a deeper thirst for meaning. We're all on that quest, everybody in here. And the point of Ecclesiastes is it's elusive. We're going everywhere to look for it. And what's fascinating is if you go back and read through, starting in chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes, the author identifies himself as a king, as someone who's the teacher of the assembly, someone who is really a philosopher king. That's the kind of teacher he is. And he lays down this challenge. He says, I'm that guy. I became greater than anyone in Jerusalem. I was the Greek god. I had it all. And the challenge, he's challenging the assumption that is in the heart of everybody in this room. And that assumption is, if only. If only I had that job. If only I had that spouse. If only I had that apartment. If only. Right? We do it all the time. It's unconscious. It surfaces. But we really believe, if only I had that, then I would be happy. Then I'd be happy. And he has come to challenge that assumption that you can find that under the sun. In this world, that you will never find meaning, no matter what you discover at the end of your sentence, if only. So that's what that's the quest that we're on and the challenge that he lays out. So let's just look at the challenge, and that's the first one. The second point is the challenge that he says we're going to fail. Now, he is, a lot of the commentators talked about that he, the king, represented a particular school of thought in Israel at the time. It was a skeptical thought. Basically that a group of people who were living as if God didn't exist, living as if even if he was there, maybe he wasn't good, that we could probably find purpose on our own. It's very similar to today. Many people would say, well, we live in a kind of post-Christian secular culture, and the word secular is a word that comes, it's a Latin word that means God may or may not exist. But regardless of whether you believe that he exists, we search for relevance in life. We search for meaning. We solve problems. We discern what's right and wrong without God. That's what it means. And that's exactly what Ecclesiastes is challenging. You can find that stuff on your own. There were not a lot of atheists in his time, but there's not a lot of atheists in modern. There's more agnostics, right? Maybe he exists, maybe he doesn't. It's not really relevant to my life. I can find the end of the if only on my own under the sun without God. And so he says, I was greater than anyone. I was those people. See, what is a king? A king can be as rich and successful and educated and hedonistic as he wants. Mel Brooks was right. It's good to be the king. It's good to be the king. You can have it all. And so he says, well, I'll take that bet. I'll take that challenge. And I will lay it out for you. And he's not playing games. The very first word out of his mouth in chapter 1, verse 2, is meaningless. Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. But what he does do is he begins to prove his point, because he's saying, if there is nothing beyond the sun, then there's nothing that matters under the sun. See, if there's nothing beyond the sun, then nothing matters under the sun. If this world is all there is, then nothing you achieve in this world ultimately matters. Because if there is nothing beyond the walls of this world, if you're living as if there's nothing beyond the walls, then who can say what's right and wrong? Who can say what's just? Who can say that achievements matter? None of it matters. None of it matters. Meaningless. He just lays it all out there. But then he goes down and says, let's prove it. I'll show you, because I've lived it. I've experienced it. So it's a gift before we make some of the same mistakes. And so he says, I'm going to look at it through pleasure, work, and wisdom. So I'm just going to tease those out, because those are three ways that the human community has always sought to find meaning in life. And they're reasonable ways to seek meaning. And you can get joy and satisfaction from those things, but will they really satisfy our deepest longings? So he says, I've lived a hedonistic lifestyle. Verse 10, I denied myself nothing that my eyes desire. Now some of you are thinking, wow, that lucky guy. He had everything at his disposal. Chapter 2, he says, earlier in the chapter, I tried cheering myself with wine. That's just a very fancy way of saying, I just went and got wasted. I got drunk. I did everything I wanted. Whenever I did, no holes barred. I didn't deny myself any appetite. If only, some of us are thinking, if only I could get rid of that job. If only I didn't have to pay rent. If only I didn't have all these obligations. Then I would be happy. I could live like those people that I see in those reality shows or whatever it is, right? I could be happy. I could have it. But in the end, he says, see in verse 9, my wisdom stayed with me. Now that comes up over and over again. What he's saying is, not only is this an experiment and I'm trying to figure out whether this actually works, but I can't turn my mind off. I can't deny who I am. I can live an amoral life. I can trample on people. But in the morning, I wake up and I still know who I am. I know it's not enough. This Albert Camus, right, in The Fall. I read it last week before the beginning of the service. Because I long for eternal life, I went to bed with harlots and I drank for nights on end. But in the morning, to be sure, my mouth was filled with the bitter taste of the mortal state. See, what is he saying? I couldn't turn my mind off. I couldn't deny what I already know, that there's more to life than this. And there's all these kind of happiness research that's going on now. I remember years ago, I think Daniel Gilbert teaches a class at Harvard. It's like one of the most popular classes at Harvard, because we're on a quest for happiness. And Arthur Brooks wrote this book in 2008 called Gross National Happiness. And he found that human happiness is tied to what he called earned success, which is, in his words, real happiness comes from creating value in the lives of others. That is the antithesis of the hedonistic lifestyle. And he talks about how parents, in the throes of changing diapers, you know, when your kids don't even know you're alive, they're just a ball of screaming, crying, snot-filled, dirty diaper beings, right? But the parents, in those moments, in their deepest unhappiness over 3 o'clock in the morning having to be there, they're at their deepest contentment and joy. That the more we give our lives away, the more we help other people find joy, the happier we are. It's just, this is not a Christian book. It's just the way we are. We know that. So hedonism doesn't work. But secondly, well, what about hard work and achievement, right? If only I could get that job. If only I could achieve these certain things in my life, then I'll be happy. That's a huge thing in New York. But we're told in verse 4, down in earlier chapter 2, again, a lot of verses, we couldn't print them all. He was the author of great projects. He was an architect. He built great gardens. He did stuff that we could only imagine. achievements and success in his job and in his life. But again, he said it was meaningless. Why? Well, there's too much to go over, but starting in verse 18, right? I hated all the things that I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. In other words, what difference is it? I could hand the keys of my kingdom over to somebody who's a complete fool, and he will undo all the great things that I have done. Or even if you achieve great things in the end, and this is what he hammers over again, again and again and again, nobody's going to remember, verse 16. Maybe you'll be lucky enough to achieve something great in your life that years from now, and even centuries from now, people will know. But a million years from now, nobody's going to care. And for most of us, work is, you know, verse 22. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving which with they labor? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds don't rest. Even if you love your job, you know that it keeps you up at night. It gives you the opposite of peace and rest and joy because you're striving. It isn't enough. There was this play that called Exit the King, and it was there was a remake of it in 2009 with Jeffrey Rush, and it's a play about a king who's 400 years old. And he was credited with writing Shakespeare plays and inventing the wheelbarrow and doing all these things that Greek gods would do, right? These permanent things that changed the world. But he's told at the very beginning of the play that he's going to die. And so the whole play is this unraveling of realizing that he really is going to die because he just assumed he was going to go on forever and could enjoy the achievements of his life. And so Ben Brantley wrote this in the review. You can understand why producers would flinch at the idea of a play that spends more than 2 hours telling theatergoers that they're going to die, like it or not. This is the United States, where people still half believe in the possibility of immortality through plastic surgery, gym memberships, and green tea. But what he's saying is, we may deceive ourselves for a moment to think, wow, look what I've done, look what I've created, look what I've achieved. But we can't turn our minds off. We can't deny what my wisdom is always with me. In the 1960s, when that play came out, the review put it this way. The whole premise of the play is, why was I born if it wasn't forever? Why was I born if it wasn't forever? Who cares that you made partner? 1,000 years from now, nobody's going to know. Why was I born if it wasn't forever? So as great as work is, as great as achievements are, if only, it doesn't satisfy under the sun. But what about wisdom? Now, wisdom, we've spent 3 weeks on this earlier in the fall, and wisdom isn't just being smart, isn't just having a high IQ. It's actually a wise person leaves the world a better place for having lived. A wise person leaves the world a better place for having lived. They're the opposite of the hedonist, right? They are lives marked by humility and self-sacrifice and self-control and kindness. There's a moral element to being a wise person. And he's saying, look, of course, in the short run, verses 13 and 14, it's much better to be wise than be fool. I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than dark. Of course you should live this way. But he says in the end, verse 15, right, because you can't turn your brain off, what gain is there? In other words, what permanent gain is there? What is really accomplished by being a wise person, by being a humble person, by being a sacrificial person? Because in the end, verse 16, whether you're a wise person or a foolish person, you will be forgotten. Why was I born if it wasn't forever? I watched on ESPN this week, there was a short 15 minutes by Ed Burns put together this little movie, little segment on what he called a Man in the Red Bandana. Some of you may have seen it. And it was about this guy who, went to Boston College, and I think he played lacrosse or field hockey or one of those. And it was about this kid who always wore a red bandana from the time he was young. And he graduated from college, and he took a job down on Wall Street at the World Trade Center on the 104th floor. And he was an equities trader. And he had called his dad, I think the day before 9/11. And he said, if I have to stare at this screen one more day, I think I'm going to go crazy. In other words, okay, I've achieved it. I've made it. I'm on Wall Street, but it doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't satisfy me. And I think his dad, I don't remember, had been a firefighter, and he said to us, I want to be a firefighter. I want to do something important with my life. I want to be wise. I want to leave the world a better place for having lived here. And then the next day, whew, Tower 2. And so they were interviewing this one woman who said, it was chaos, I couldn't see, and I heard this voice said, follow me. I found the staircase. And we all followed this guy with a red bandana down the stairs. And he brought us down to the 60th floor. And instead of going down with us, he went back up. And then the tower collapsed. And so months go by. And one day, the mom of this kid reads in the newspaper that these people remember this young man in a red bandana saving them. And the light goes on. She goes, that was my son. And so it turns out he saved 12 people's lives that day. 12 people. And he died in the process. That's a wise, heroic, noble thing. And so they had the red bandana race at Boston College. He was made an honorary firefighter here, so that at the firehouse where he grew up in Nyack, New York, he's the last face that the firefighters see every time they go out for a fire. His dad tattooed number 19 on his chest, which is the number he wore in sports growing up, because every day he goes, what? I want to remember him. I want to remember him. They're keeping his memory alive. It's a great thing. But the author of Ecclesiastes is saying, yes, it's a great thing. Of course, it's a great thing. But think about it. Because if there's nothing else but what we see under the sun, if this life is all there is, then in the long run, the people who planned the attack and the heroes who rescued people are all going to die and they're all going to be forgotten. What difference does it make? There is no God, there is no truth, there is no justice, there is no heroism that survives. There's no real lasting impact on the world. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So what's the conclusion? Verse 17, I hated life. I hated life. Because it's all meaningless under the sun. That's the despair. That's what Kierkegaard called the sickness unto death. And see, he says in his writing, Kierkegaard, that the sickness unto death is sin. And it's not sin the way we would normally religiously kind of define it. It's seeking yourself. Finding yourself, finding your identity, satisfying your quest, your thirst in a life apart from God. It's not living authentically as if God exists. That's despair. Because none of the things satisfy. As great as those things are, they just leave you bitter and envious and hard-hearted and cynical towards other people. You leave the world worse off because you've been here. That's the sickness unto death. That's the effect of sin in your life, of trying to live as if there is no God or ignoring him. You see, Paul in Romans chapter 1 summarizes it perfectly. He says, the misery in my life, the misery in your life, the misery of the world is because we believe a lie. He says, you want to know what sin is? We have exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And we worship the created things as opposed to the creator. That is it in a nutshell. There's nothing wrong with pleasure. There's nothing wrong with achievement. There's nothing wrong with heroism. But if it becomes your God, if it becomes your source of identity, if it's all about you, and notice how all the pronouns are about my achievements, me, 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 me. But they're not a means to an end to serve God. Then your soul will collapse under the weight of it. Because the writer of Ecclesiastes says in chapter 3, God has set eternity in the hearts of everybody in this room, and we all know it. We all know it. And sin is believing the lie and disordering our lives and disordering our loves and disordering our priorities, putting ourselves first and God last. It is this despair, Kierkegaard says, that comes from not wanting to be ourselves before God. It's knowing that he's there, but ignoring him. That is the sickness unto death. That's chasing after the wind. That's living as if there's nothing beyond the walls of this world. He says, I've tried it. It's a challenge. You'll fail every time. So that's the quest. That's the challenge. But is there any hope? And we get a glimpse of hope towards the end of the chapter. Now, there's two different ways, as I was thinking about it, that there is hope. And one is, it's just the relentless logic that the author used. That is, he didn't try to prove his point by using a religious premise. He was trying to prove his point using a secular premise. He didn't say, well, let me show you from the Bible. Let me show you from the religious writing. No, let me just show you from your own premise that there is no God or that that you're indifferent to him, why it doesn't work. And what that does actually is opens a window, the despair, the meaninglessness, the I hated life is a window that allows you to see there is something beyond the sun, that there is something beyond the walls of this world. That just like if you go too long without food and water, you're hungry, that points to a physical reality that there is food and water. So this deep longing that we have for meaning and significance and joy and purpose, that is a hunger. And it points to something that can satisfy that hunger. It's just logical. That can fill something that will actually fill your soul. See, the main way that he refutes the secular point of view is by showing us that we cannot account for all the things that we already know, the wisdom that stays with us, because we all know that there is such a thing as right and wrong. We all know that there is such a thing as beauty. We all know that there is a difference between living a kind and a cruel life. We know it intuitively. And so if you think out the implications, he's saying, look through the window and realize that there is something beyond the sun, not just under the sun. So that's one way. Actually, that just the relentless logic and the despair, actually, bringing you to the end of yourself actually can bring you to the beginning of yourself. But it's not enough. Because there has to be something more than just this general idea. Is there a God? Is he good? What's he like? And the glimpse that we get in verse 24 and 26 is that we see the hand of God and the pleasure of God. See that, verse 24? The hand and pleasure of God. Now, as I was thinking about this, it just struck me that when he mentions the hand of God, what does that represent? God's grace. He's basically saying anything that you do enjoy in this world, and there are a lot of things to enjoy in this world. It's a gift from God. It's a gift from God's hand. That his joy is your joy. His delight is giving you delight. His pleasure is giving you pleasure. He's a God of grace. He's a God of grace. And then that grace leads to, verse 26, a relationship based on pleasing. In other words, he isn't just giving you something and then leaving. He wants to know you. He wants to be known. He wants a reciprocity in this relationship. And his grace is the doorway into that kind of relationship. You don't please him first and then get his grace. He gives you his hand. He gives you his grace as a way to enjoy a relationship with him. And that is the antidote to the sickness unto death. Because if God is eternal, if his love is eternal, if his grace is eternal, then your pleasure with him is eternal. There is a way back. There is something to satisfy you in the deepest part of your heart. Back in Easter, I mentioned this book. I may have mentioned it since, The Brief History of Thought by the French philosopher Luc Ferry, Ferry, and he's an atheist. He doesn't believe in Christianity, but he points out in his book that what it means to be human can be summed up this way, that in the end, what we all want is, in short, not to die and not to have our loved ones die on us, right? That's the Exit the King play. We don't want to die, and we don't want the people we love to die. We want to live forever, but we don't want to live forever alone. We want to be with the people who are in a relationship. We want to please and be pleased by one another. We want that. That's what we were built for. And so Ferry says in his book, the best antidote to the despair of this world, to the fear of death, to the sickness unto death, is Christianity. I don't believe it. I don't buy it. But there's nothing better. Because of the person of Jesus Christ. He is come from beyond the walls of this world. The creator of the sun, moon, and stars invaded the sun, moon, and stars. He was the hand of God extended to us so that we can make our way back. See, on the cross was the portal. The cross was the way back. The cross. Jesus experienced the deepest sickness unto death. He experienced eternal futility and despair. He was forsaken by God the Father, who he had known from all eternity. Why? For you. And for me, to heal the sickness, he experienced an eternity of hell on the cross. infinite agony, infinite emptiness, infinite despair. That's what hell is. That's what the wrath of God is. He experienced all of that so that we will never have to experience it again. That's what he did. He did that for us. See, the just thing, the righteous thing to do for all of us who have lived our lives as if he didn't exist, if we took on the challenge of Ecclesiastes, I will live my life under the sun as if God didn't exist, then the just thing for God to do was say, fine, you can have an eternity of that. You can have an eternity of life without me. That's hell. But Jesus says, I'll take that so that you can have an eternity of life with God. There's nothing better. There's no other antidote I know than what Jesus did on the cross. Let me just close with this. The experience of Jesus when he was on the cross, I've used this over the years with people. I've used it on my own heart because, look, we all suffer discouragement and despair and wondering if things are really, if there's meaning in life. I mean, that's just a human condition. And so you have to go back to what you believe, right? And so Jesus is on the cross. He's existentially coming apart. He's been physically beaten. He's experiencing the wrath of his Father. And this guy next to him who's getting what he deserves, he's a criminal, he turns to him and he says to Jesus the one thing that is in the heart of everybody in this room, the ultimate, deepest, primal prayer, remember me. Remember me. You know, I don't want to fade away like the grains of sand that'll be blown by the winds 1,000 years from now. Because I don't want this to be the end. I want this to be the beginning. I don't know how you're going to remember me because there are so many things in my life that I want to forget. So many things that I have done to myself and to other people that are not worthy of you remembering me. But all I know is that I, deep down in my soul, I don't want to be forgotten. Remember me. And Jesus says to him, today, you will be with me in paradise. There is an end to the quest. There is a paradise. Jesus did it for us. So there is meaning, there's purpose, there's joy, there's peace, there's contentment, there's hope. In the midst of our despair, you can taste it. You can see it. He is good. Let's go to the table now. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the hard truth that you give us, that all of our searching apart from you, as wonderful as the things that we can achieve, ultimately leave us in despair. So for allowing your son to experience the ultimate despair so that we could feast now as a community of hope, we thank and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.